Welcome to the Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and podcast on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 and 103.7, and streaming live at radiofreenashville.org.
What's being done is just a deliberate effort to obscure any line between criticism of Israel and outright anti-Semitism. I like to say, sadly, that the lobby's not content to take rights away from Palestinians. They want to take rights away from Americans as well.
That was Dr. Walter Hickson, historian and commentator, and you will hear more from Dr. Hickson as we discuss the dangers of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, and the rest of the Israel lobby. But first, my name is Jim Wolgemuth, and I'm here with fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett. We're members of Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace is an international organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace, humanity, equality, and justice. Just go to veteransforpeace.org. This radio show and podcast is on stations across the country thanks to the Pacific Radio Network. We are also on SoundCloud, Anchor Podcasts, Spotify, and your phone podcast app. Just search Veterans for Peace. The Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and Radio Free Nashville are supported in part by you, the listener, because it is you that keeps Radio Free Nashville going. And as a result, this radio show is then picked up by the Pacifica Radio Network so that we are heard across the country. So if you think this is important, just go to radiofreenashville.org, click on donate, and keep Harvey and I on the air in every time zone in the U.S. And if you support the work of Veterans for Peace, go to our site, veteransforpeace.org. Today, we have Dr. Walter Hickson, historian, commentator, whose work has focused on the intersection of American culture and foreign relations. A prolific writer, Hickson has produced a series of works critically examining the history of U.S. foreign relations. His most recent book is Imperialism and War, the History Americans Need to Own. For the past decade, Hickson has focused much of his attention on the Middle East, and especially the issue of Israel-Palestine. In 2021, he published a comprehensive history of the crucial role of the Israel lobby in the Palestinian conflict. The book is entitled Architects of Repression: How Israel and its lobby put racism, violence, and injustice at the center of U.S. Middle East policy. Architects of Repression was the follow-up to a previous study entitled Israel's Armor: The Israel Lobby and the First Generation of Palestine Conflict. These richly researched studies have established Hickson as a leading expert on the Israel lobby, spearheaded by AIPAC, which is by far the largest, most well-funded, and influential lobby acting on behalf of a foreign country in American history. Okay, to say he is prolific would be an understatement. And while there are many topics we could discuss, we want to focus on AIPAC and its dangerous influence on U.S. politics, foreign policy, freedom of speech, education, whether it's on the campus or in high school, and more. So, Dr. Hickson, have I gone too far as that assessment on how dangerous AIPAC is?
No, I don't think so. It's certainly a deleterious force in our society. There's no question. For all the reasons you cite, not just bolstering Israeli repression, but also, as you pointed out, undermining, freedom of speech and traditional American values.
Where did AIPAC start?
Well, the first book you mentioned, Israel's Armor, is more of a formal academic study. For general readers, I recommend Architects of Repression, where I go over everything. But in more depth in Israel's Armor, I looked at the foundations of the lobby. And it goes back to the end of World War II, the aftermath of the Nazi genocide, and the formation of Israel as a state and its recognition by the UN. But before that happened, American Jews, and there were more Jews living in the United States than anywhere else in the world, and really New York was the center of the international Zionist movement, there was a great concern, understandably, for Jewish refugees from the Nazis. And once Israel was being created, American Jews got together and lobbied for funding for relocation of Jewish refugees. And that was the beginning of the lobby. And their organizational efforts were so successful that they realized that they could command great influence in Congress and get funding for Zionist, the Zionist movement. And they've been getting it ever since.
Well, why were they so successful?
They were well organized. They were centered in the Northeast, where most power was centered in the United States, particularly at that time, before the Sun Belt and all of that. There was a level of guilt in the United States over relative inactivity over the Nazi genocide. And Jews were clearly victims. And so a lot of people could rally behind helping Jewish refugees. But they were just smart and well organized and started letter writing campaigns, lobbying the local representatives. It graduated to rewarding those who supported what the lobby wanted and punishing those who did not, and was very well organized locally. Local Jewish federations connected with national organizations, such as the Congress of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. There were close ties with the Israeli state after it emerged. So the lobby was, you might say, vertically integrated from the bottom up in the United States and overseas. And it's just a very well organized lobby that eventually became AIPAC. There were several predecessor organizations, but by around 1960, AIPAC became the central organization, which it remains today. But there are literally hundreds of Jewish lobbying organizations and Zionist lobbying organizations, because they're not all Jewish. They're, of course, are Christian Zionists. So there are really too many to even know, hundreds of these organizations. But no question, AIPAC is the centerpiece.
Of course, now with the favorable response from the ICJ, I'm sure AIPAC is working overtime to undermine that in any way they can. Can you give us any idea what to expect?
Well, I'm better versed in the history than I mean, of course, I follow what's going on now, but I don't have any
Yeah.
particular knowledge that
Right.
you might not have. But yes, I mean, I know without knowing, if you will.
Right.
They're working overtime, absolutely, on that, and they are relentless. You could look up online AIPAC headquarters and see the tall building in Washington, D.C. There's over 300 employees. I always am amazed by people who deny the influence of the lobby, and there's a lot of that. Ironically, the lobby promotes denying of the existence of the lobby. But there's over 300 propagandists always at work in the United States, particularly in the Congress, which they, I use it. It's a very strong term, but I'm pretty comfortable using it. They own the U.S. Congress. The U.S. Congress does what Israel and the lobby want them to do. I mean, witness today, we've got the slaughter of 25,000 people going on, children being killed every day. And, it doesn't stop. It's not brought to a halt. And the United States, as is often the case, is standing relatively alone in world affairs in opposing a ceasefire. So the lobby's always at work. It's a real thing. This is not some conspiracy theory. They're very good at what they do. They're very experienced and very good at it, as you would expect a powerful lobby to be. You wouldn't expect Big Pharma to be bad at its job. You wouldn't expect the old elderly person's lobby to be bad at its job. And they're not. They're very good at it. They're very good at lobbying. And it's by far the most powerful lobby representing the interests of a foreign country in American history. But it's one of the most powerful lobbies, period, in American life.
But even Big Pharma and military industrial complex, all these amazing influencers, they don't attack people the way AIPAC seems bent on doing in terms of smearing and
Yeah.
accusations. And I expect they'll be revving that up
Now
to
that's a really good point. I'm glad you mentioned that. One of the major arguments I have in Architects of Repression is that what's unique about Israel? So historically speaking, Israel, like the United States, like Australia, like many other countries, is a I like to describe it as a congenitally aggressive, that is, aggressive from birth, settler society. It's a product of settler colonialism. So is the United States. And this is just a phenomenon where you come in, you root out the indigenous population, and you take the land for yourself, and you depict yourself as the as it is your homeland, and displace the original inhabitants. So in that sense, Israel's not unlike the United States, and that helps explain why they're so closely associated. But here's the big difference, and getting to your question or the point you raised. It was one thing for Israel or for the United States and Australia in the 19th century to be rooting out indigenous people and conducting ethnic cleansing and killing quote unquote savages, etc. It's quite another thing after World War II, when, ironically, because of the Nazi genocide, in large part, along with general Nazi militarism and Japanese militarism, the UN was created and promulgated the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So, in other words, Israel comes to birth and conducts cleansing operations at the very moment that the international community is establishing a structure in the UN to try to keep this from happening again. So, the point here is that this makes propaganda and disinformation and attack on critics all the more important because it's not legitimate to be a repressive ethnic cleansing state. And in order to exist in that climate, you have to deny that you are an illegitimate, relentlessly oppressive ethnic cleansing state, apartheid state. Israel is clearly an apartheid state now. You can't be a democracy and privilege one group of people over another. That's apartheid. And so that's what they are. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is the lobby is super important and attacks on critics are super important, having to do with Israel coming of age late as a repressive settler state, as opposed to the history of the United States and Australia, for example.
Can you give us a couple of examples specifically of candidates, people in Congress or whatever, that AIPAC has actually come out against and maybe derailed their candidacy? I mean, I would think off the top of my head, Nina Turner from Ohio a couple of years ago, there was a lot of AIPAC money along with problems with the DNC that derailed her when she was up double digits for a long time.
Yeah, also gerrymandering here in Ohio is pretty bad. Helped derail her. Sure, I mean they routinely go up against any critical voices in Congress. They're very blatant about it. You either support us or we'll find somebody who does and try to replace you. And they use money to do that. They don't always win. So Ilhan Omar, they'd love to get rid of her from Minnesota, but her local people keep rallying behind her. Betty McConnell, also of Minnesota, who's committed the sin of promoting a bill that would end incarceration of children in Israel. They don't want to have that.
And I found this clip from Counterpoints, part of Breaking Points. This is Ryan Grimm and Emily Kaczynski.
The context, of course, is that AIPAC is putting together an unprecedented level of spending to try to wipe out the squad in Congress. Meanwhile, they're facing a cascading number of their own scandals. We'll talk about Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman, and Ilhan Omar in this segment. Let's start with Cori Bush. It was reported yesterday that she's under DOJ investigation for over her campaign spending on security.
Yeah, she does have a primary challenge, right, that's being funded by AIPAC.
Wesley Bell was running for Senate, jumped out of the Senate race and into the House race after October 7th, when it appeared that Bush could be vulnerable to a well-financed challenger. He announced he had raised $600,000. AIPAC has already been spending. AIPAC was spending against her before she had an opponent through its super PAC. So that, yes, they're absolutely coming for her. So this will wind up, I think, in all of the super PAC ads that, because Marie Newman, who AIPAC took out in 2022, because she represented a huge kind of Palestinian population in Illinois, had a congressional ethics review underway, and they made that like the focus of their massive spending against her. So if you have 30 seconds, and if to do an ad, and you got $1 million to spread it, you can make someone look really, really bad. We'll see whether or not people kind of believe it. So Bowman is also facing an AIPAC-backed challenger, George Latimer, Westchester County executive.
So they routinely target all critics and promote financially and otherwise their supporters, and they don't always win, but they win a lot. And there are other than those few progressive critics, and Bernie Sanders pretty much alone in the Senate, It's almost not an exaggeration to say no one criticizes Israel. It's not legitimate in this culture and society to criticize Israel traditionally, but it's changing. And the more they, you know, do this blatant slaughter of people, the more it's changing. And also very important, our larger numbers of American Jews are questioning their unquestioned previously support for Israel. For generations, it was sort of the duty of an American Jew to be pro-Israel. And that was through Jewish education institutions, et cetera, emphasized. But American Jews are generally more liberal and progressive people, and they're more and more, larger numbers are alert to the fact that the Israel they've supported is not the Israel that really exists. So things are changing. But, you know, in Congress, I tell the story of Mitch McConnell. He narrowly won election in Kentucky in 1984 against the incumbent T. Huddleston. And McConnell, of course, who's a brilliant political operator, went to AIPAC, who supported the incumbent Huddleston because he was fairly favorable to them. And he said, "Hey, fellas, what can I do to get your support next time?" And they said, "That's easy, Mitch. Just do what we tell you to do. Support Israel uncritically and you'll be fine." He has. And ever since now, McConnell has received more financial assistance from AIPAC than any other politician in American history. Even more troubling to me, it's probably not fair to single him out, but I always discuss the case of Cory Booker, a senator from New Jersey who's African-American and eloquent in his pleas for justice. On Martin Luther King Day, he routinely gives a beautiful speech about King's influence and justice and equality. And then he toes the line 100% on Israeli repression of Palestine. So it just shows you how powerful the lobby is. And scholars and journalists refer to the Palestine exception. You know, it's support for human rights and victims of repression, except for Palestine. And it doesn't happen there.
Has their tentacles reached down into states and local governments?
Oh, absolutely. It's connected with local Jewish federations. One of the reasons I got to really know about the lobby was I wrote an article in our local newspaper, the Akron Beacon Journal. I wrote an op-ed piece critical of Israeli policies, and replies poured in from the local Jewish federations and leaders, and it was clear that it was an orchestrated attack. That's what they do. They rally against any critics, for any supporters. It begins at the local level. They're tied in with state and national organizations, and they're linked up with the Israeli state as well. I mean, AIPAC has an office in Jerusalem. It's no secret that they work closely together.
Do you think they're behind some of the legislation that some states have said can't be behind the BDS program?
It's important that you mentioned BDS. So there's a couple of points where the lobby really accelerated its activism. So I'll put it in historical context and then talk about more of the present. In the Reagan administration, Reagan was very pro-Israel, but the United States was also interested in cultivating Saudi Arabia and sold defensive weapons system to Saudi Arabia in the early 1980s. This was opposed sharply by the lobby, but Reagan was a popular president. It narrowly passed, and the lobby decided to redouble its efforts. So more money was pumped in, and most of the money pumped in is from a handful of super rich Orthodox Jews. Very conservative Orthodox Jews. Most Jews are not Orthodox or very conservative, but the handful that are super rich, and Reagan was at the same time initiating massive tax cuts, which enabled these wealthy donors to give even more money. Mm-hmm. So they bolstered their efforts in the 1980s. So the point I'm making is when the lobby feels threatened, it redoubles its efforts and pumps more money into its propaganda and disinformation. All right, speed ahead to the 2000s, and we've got the BDS that you mentioned, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So this, on the South African model, as you know, was a campaign to try to punish Israel economically by boycotting and sanctioning it, boycotting its products, isolating it internationally economically. And this was a serious threat to Israel and the lobby, and they've responded with an extremely active and well-funded attack program that you alluded to. And it's come to the point where criticism of Israel is routinely equated with anti-Semitism. And that's what's happening at the state level with these primitive legislative initiatives that you mentioned that essentially do that and attack universities and professors as well. You know, one of the most disgusting lobby efforts has been an entity called Canary Mission, which online condemns not just professors, but students in groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, equates them with being anti-Semites. You're right. What's being done is just a deliberate effort to obscure any line between criticism of Israel and outright anti-Semitism. I like to say, sadly, that the lobby's not content to take rights away from Palestinians. They want to take rights away from Americans as well.
Do they have any direct connection to any defamation league? It seems like they're at least working from a similar playbook a lot of the time.
Oh, sure. Anti-Defamation League is part of the lobby. When I reference the lobby, I'm using a small L encompassing a vast number of groups. It's not just AIPAC. AIPAC, because of the annual conferences it used to hold. Okay. And by the way, it's interesting that they aren't holding these any longer. They suspended them for COVID, but haven't restarted them. I think they have come to the conclusion that they're a little too blatant. All these Israeli flags, all these members of Congress prostrating themselves before the Israeli flag and coming and giving these speeches about how great Israel is and how criticism of it is anti-Semitic, et cetera. It's a little too blatant, I think they've decided, and they're opting for a little subtlety. But yeah, the ADF is a big part of the lobby. So there's, as I mentioned, hundreds of groups that you can lump into the lobby and work together. They don't always agree on everything, but in general, they do and are on the same page and are extremely well-organized and determined lobby.
Is Israel concerned at all that the optics of the fact that so often the targets of their attacks are people of color?
Apparently not. And, you know, there's also, they're able to build on a little bit of a historic alliance between Jews and African Americans as discriminated groups that have been historically discriminated against in American society. And I mentioned Booker as a good example, you know, of how that holds up to some extent. But, you know, it's an apartheid state, and you would think that would arouse all sorts of charges of racism, and it does in other countries and in the UN, but not in the United States. If your listeners aren't aware, they should look into the history of American vetoes of UN Security Council resolutions on Israel. And it's amazing. The votes are, you know, like 104-2 with the United States and Israel and maybe throw in the Marshall Islands opposing these efforts and the U.S. vetoing censures and resolutions. So most of the world does get this connection that you mentioned between racism and Israeli actions. But in the United States, not so much. The U.S. is also the heartland of Christian Zionism. That's a factor as well. And, you know, I wouldn't overrate it, particularly on the funding. They don't fund it as much as these Orthodox Jews individuals do, you know, like Sheldon Adelson, the former casino magnate who died, but his wife still pumps bazillions into the lobby. But the on the ground support by Christian Zionists is important as well.
But they couldn't do all of this without media complicity, right?
Oh, that's a major problem. Yes, I agree totally. You know, it's not that the media is formally part of the lobby and conniving with them. It doesn't particularly work that way. But certainly the New York Times has played a major role. I mentioned New York as the traditional heartland of Zionism. New York Times coverage has been warped and unfavorable from the get-go. I mean, it's a great newspaper that has a lot of outstanding reporting. But again, the Palestine exception has appeared throughout the history of this conflict and of the New York Times. For example, when human rights organizations, including the Israeli Human Rights Organization, said that it was appropriate to call Israel an apartheid state, the New York Times didn't even cover that. You know, there's a lot of very dubious reporting on these Hamas rapes. Alleged rapes. There's very little formal evidence of this. And I'm not here to promote Hamas or particularly defend Hamas, although it should be pointed out that Israel helped create Hamas, and if it wasn't for Israeli repression, there would be no Hamas. But when you look at all the information, there's very little direct evidence. You would think there would be photographic and video evidence. You know, we watch all these crime shows on television. There's plenty of ways to demonstrate that things happen conclusively, and they haven't done that. And I'm also dubious. We'll see. I'm not saying it's wrong or denying it necessarily, but this charge of the UN workers aiding Hamas, it may very well be so. We should treat every report as with a very critical eye, because the propaganda does get into the media. And you're certainly correct that the U.S. media has traditionally been very pro-Israel and reluctant to criticize or report effectively on Israeli apartheid and repression. I wouldn't go too far with it. There is a lot of critical reporting, particularly outside the mainstream. There's a lot of sources of knowledge about Israel's cleansing and repression and apartheid. But in general, I agree with your statement that the media has been largely complicit in this issue.
I remember seeing a recent documentary on Israel's management of media and how they control the narrative.
It's a great documentary. This slaughter in Gaza today is unique because it's so massive and it's a formal war, but it's not the first time that Israel has indiscriminately bombed and slaughtered people in Gaza. Mm-hmm. There were major wars. They're not really wars, they're slaughters. I mean, this is one of the most elite militarized states in the world history against a densely populated, largely defenseless country with rudimentary weapons that it does has fired, of course, these rockets, which do relatively little damage to Israel, whereas Israel just pummels Gaza. Mm-hmm. And so the film focuses on that. You know, hopefully before we're done.
But even a lot of people have pointed out that, you know, just the terminology that's used to describe what happened to Israel versus what's happening to Gaza. Adjectives like horrific,
yeah, they
only show, you know, have been thousands of citations for what happened
exactly.
To Israel. But none of it for the 25,000 dead.
You make a good point. They establish talking points,
right,
and key phrases. And you can tell it's orchestrated because they're repeated up and down the line, you know, from local level to international level. And it's clearly an orchestrated propaganda effort that doesn't necessarily come off that way. And, you know, that film really shows how they do that.
And I've just noticed, you know, the networks or cable, when they do interview an Israeli spokesperson, it's like they have a script.
Let me interrupt you for 1 second, because I think, Jim, are you looking for it?
I'm trying, yeah.
The narrator of that was Roger Waters of Pink Floyd. So
okay.
That might help you find the name of it. I'm sorry, go ahead. I interrupted.
When they're questioned like about the desecration of cemeteries or the attacking of hospitals, and the script that the Israelis use basically say human shields or,
right,
you know, these, you know, and that there's never any follow-up question. There's never any challenge to that from the
No,
press.
That's right. It's very chilling. I've seen a couple of interviews with, you know, Israeli military officials in the mainstream media, and they are asking them, they say, what about the slaughter of civilians and innocents? And they say, well, that's all Hamas's fault. They put their, you know, their operations in. And it's really chilling because they're essentially justifying mass slaughter and certainly exaggerating the extent to which, of course, Hamas is going to try to insulate itself as much as possible. But it's vastly overstated.
Is it the occupation of the American mind?
Yes, it is. That's
Bingo.
The film. So I'm glad you mentioned it. So I urge everyone, if you can, watch that documentary, The Occupation of the American Mind. It may be 6, 8 years old now, but exactly what it shows really illustrates how the lobby operates and gets these talking points and select phrases out there. Thank you for looking that up.
Sure. And I just happen to have the trailer.
A July 8th, 2014, Israel launched a devastating military attack on the Gaza Strip. Over the course of 51 days, the Israeli military dropped nearly 20,000 tons of explosive on Gaza, a densely populated area the size of Philadelphia, killing over 2,000 Palestinians and wounding tens of thousands more.
Israel is under siege by a terrorist organization.
This is not an illusion. American public opinion is generally supportive of Israel because it's been led to believe that Israel is in the right and the Arabs are bad guys.
When we looked at mainstream media outlets, Israeli spokespeople overrepresented compared to Palestinian spokespeople. So almost every time you turned on the screen, there was a Israeli representative on the screen telling you Israel is the one that's in a position of defense. It is being attacked.
And basically Israel is saying, hey, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that if rockets fly on your head, you're allowed to defend yourself.
This is how propaganda works. It works by getting your words in the mouths of other people, especially the mouths of supposedly objective media commentators.
Israel has the right to defend itself against Hamas, of course, a group that is firing rockets on Israel coming out of tunnels to attack Israelis.
Any advertising executive will tell you the essence of propaganda is repetition.
Rockets raining down on southern Israel.
Rockets raining down on Israel.
Well, Hamas rockets rained down on Israeli border towns.
Rockets were raining down on Israel.
Our media operations. National media is a scandal when it comes to Israel.
Everyone who's trying to tell the American public a different side of the story has already crossed a barrier of fear.
As long as the United States supports Israel, nothing's going to happen. The U.S. government will support it as long as the U.S. population tolerates it.
Do you think AIPAC and the Israel lobby has actually got us into shooting circumstances, a shooting war? And by the way, we're talking to Dr. Walter Hickson about the impact of the Israeli lobby and especially AIPAC.
Well, yeah, I think so. And particularly interesting for you all as a veterans organization. What I hear quite often is from people is, well, you know, isn't Israel an important ally for us? You know, I know they do some bad things, but don't we need that important ally in the Middle East? And my usual rejoinder is, well, what has that gotten us? It's gotten us a series of forever wars, which we're on the brink of another one now. I mean, I'm not predicting it, but it's becoming very dicey with Iran and the Houthis and this naval warfare that's going on. So I don't see that the Israeli alliance has been very productive for the United States. I'm not saying that the lobby in Israel got the United States into the Iraq war or the Afghan war, but I am saying that they cheered it on, particularly the Iraq war, and want the United, that would love the United States to join them in war against Iran. They've been pushing for a war with Iran for at least a decade, if not three or four. So I don't see that this much vaunted alliance has been very good for the United States. Nobody really thinks that the Iraq war and the Afghan war were glorious achievements of the United States. And this is something that Israel and the lobby promoted, and they want the United States deeply engaged militarily in the Middle East as much as possible. And of course, they work very closely together. One of you mentioned the hackneyed, but still, there's no better phrase, military-industrial complex. It's alive and well, and Israel and the United States are very much in league in, as I'm sure you all know, in promoting weapons, new weapon systems, militarism. And the United States, of course, hands Israel a formal check every year of $3.8 billion. It's the only country that gets the money without in it. It's called early dispersal, so that Israel gets to collect the interest on the money. And that's not all the money that they get. That's just the formal part of the 10-year agreement that Obama signed. And, you know, that's a good example. Obama understood apartheid very well, of course, being African-American, but he was very pro-Israel, despite the Iran treaty, which was an effort to bring some sanity to relations with Iran and to prevent a war and to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Other than that, Obama was very pro-Israel and yet was relentlessly attacked for the Iran treaty. But anyway, he signed, of course, like every other president, this major funding bill that Israel gets every year. So it's a little country of 9 million people. It's highly advanced economically and militarily. It doesn't need American money, and yet it gets it. No questions asked by the U.S. Congress. Right. I mean, do you know any politician who stood up other than Omar and Rashida Tlaib and a few others? Bernie Sanders says make it conditional on Israeli human rights. He's ignored. Every year we write that check and you don't hear any debate about it. You hear all kinds of debate about funding the government of the United States, but not funding the government of Israel.
Right. We can't find the funds for child poverty or to get the lead pipes out of people's water.
No, it's wasted welfare money when we spend it on ourselves. But when we give it to Israel, which doesn't need it, it's no questions asked. Yeah, it's deplorable.
I think one of the clearly negative outcomes of our relationship with Israel and our behavior in the Middle East is 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, it was not the sole cause of it by any stretch.
Yeah.
But what the CIA term blowback was originated to explain deleterious effects on the homeland, on the United States itself, as a result of its actions abroad. And there's been no question. Well, I think it's fair to say that certainly, you know, I don't buy into conspiracy theories like Israel or the United States itself promoted 9/11. It's not our style to blow up stockbrokers. But they Israeli policies and American policies that Israel agreed with, this was a highly motivating factor for Osama bin Laden. He made that very clear, that Israeli repression of Palestinians, just like it's a motive for the Houthis today, the Yemenis who are attacking shipping, it's been a cause in the Arab world, although many Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAR have basically caved in, I would say, and don't maintain solidarity with Palestinians. But there's no question that Osama bin Laden and other terrorists have been motivated by U.S. unquestioned support for Israel and repression of Palestinians. No question about it.
Well, I think, too, as far as these Gulf monarchies respond, which is lip service at best, we're talking about the rulers.
If they were real democracies we were supporting, it would be different. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. They are repressive monarchies. And if you had a poll of the rank and file of the people in those countries, absolutely, they remain pro-Palestinian.
I wanted to ask, what is the effect of AIPAC on the Israel lobby on peace organizations?
Well, they attempt to attack and repress them and equate their criticism with anti-Semitism. You know, so one strategy is to ignore them, and they do a lot of that. But if they begin to be influential, they will step up and attack them and brand them as anti-Semitic. And as we've already discussed, attack free speech. Something else they do is use, of course, lawyers and law and lawfare to attack and to try to pass legislation that you already mentioned to limit free speech and equate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. So they definitely go after peace groups if they think they're influential. But it's, you know, people should be aware, if they're not already, a lot of Israelis, there is a lot of criticism within Israel, and there are human rights organizations within Israel. Now, when a war erupts, as in this country, people generally rally behind the flag, and it's very difficult to criticize the state when it's engaged in war and young men and women are dying, you know, like the Iraq War. It was very difficult, and I know, because I publicly criticized it and drew a lot of fire for it. And, you know, after a time period, people recognized that it was a disaster. But anyway, there's criticism within Israel as well as the United States, and they do their best to mute those groups and attack them and undermine them.
Is there a counterpart group like lobby within Europe?
Oh, especially in the UK, yes. It's very strong in the UK. I'd say it's as strong in the UK as it is here. And you mentioned getting people ousted. What was his name? Jeremy something. I'm sorry.
Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah,
Corbyn. Yeah, Jeremy Corbyn. Thank you. Was driven out essentially by the lobby in the UK. So it's very powerful in the UK, also influential in France and the Netherlands and other Western European countries. My expertise, such as it is on the American lobby primarily. But if you want to look at sources like the Electric Intifada is a good one. Mondo Weiss is an excellent online source. It's directed by a disenchanted and progressive Jewish American, and very strong information. IRMEP in Washington, IRMEP, is an excellent think tank, particularly on the history of the lobby and the secret actions of the lobby. If you're interested in that kind of stuff, the subterranean efforts over the years, it's a great source, IRMEP. And a magazine I wrote for, The Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, The Middle East Report is very good as well. There are sources out there.
972 is very good. I don't know if you've read much of that.
Yeah, there are a lot of them. And there's a lot of grassroots opposition, and there's a lot of international opposition. And, you know, someday, somehow, some way, you would think it's going to have an impact and things are going to change. But I don't know what it's going to take, but it is happening. One thing I've learned by studying history is it doesn't equip you to predict the future.
Right.
I'm not a forecaster, and historians aren't Nostradamus. We don't know what's going to happen, but I would think at some point there's going to be some sort of galvanizing event that'll change the narrative somehow.
Well, that kind of relates to what I was going to ask, which is we've gone through all the dangers of the Israel lobby, of AIPAC in particular, and how do we combat it? And so paying attention and supporting this independent or other media, paying attention to who is backing our candidates, what else would you suggest?
If you're knowledgeable about the issue, and you can write your local newspaper, even letters to the editor can be helpful. I think it's happening out there, the grassroots awareness. It's so blatant what's going on right now, the mass slaughter that, you know, even CNN has to talk about it, you know. So It's not just the grassroots marginal groups that or entities that I've just mentioned, and many, many others. But now more and more mainstream media, you simply can't ignore what's going on. So you sort of, you know, chip into that with talk about it at your church, write letters to the editor. You know, important talking point is this funding. You know, Americans seem to be awfully concerned about paying taxes and what it's spent on. This is just throwing money to a repressive regime that doesn't even need the money. And so, you know, Bernie Sanders' argument that, you know, Bernie Sanders is Jewish. He's hardly an anti-Semite, but his argument is we should make any assistance to Israel contingent on its actions and on its human rights policies. And so while that is a long way from having in command in Congress, because the lobby has command of Congress, ultimately, campaign finance reform and limiting of contributions would go a long way as well. But we seem to have gone in the other direction with all that. And until that turns around, the lobby is going to have great influence. But you just have to, you know, the old cliche, think globally, act locally, is all I could urge people to do.
I have to keep reminding myself, you're a historian, you know, you don't make predictions. I wish I could find someone who had a crystal ball, but, you know, I'm concerned about the fact that Netanyahu has nukes.
Yeah, that's another story that was fascinating that I studied in depth in the Israel's Armor book and also deal with in Architects of Repression. Few Americans are aware, but Israel has nuclear weapons. I think maybe people are aware of that. But they obtained them illegally and mendaciously. I see you've got a portrait of JFK behind you there. It was during his administration, he tried very hard in a very nice way to rein in the Israeli program and to get them to be honest about it. And they said, look, we're not developing a bomb, Mr. President. We're not doing that. And it was just a blatant lie. They were doing it, and they did do it, and they have nuclear weapons, and they introduced them to the Middle East. And of course, they're very determined to the point of wanting a war with Iran to keep Iran or any other country from having them, which is ironic to an extreme because the Iran treaty would have kept Iran from having the nuclear weapons. But now that, you know, the door is open. So we'll see what happens with all that. But it's Israel that has brought nuclear weapons and destabilization to the Middle East in that regard, and did so in a highly mendacious way.
And the other supreme irony I'm seeing is South Africa.
Yes, there's an excellent book about that relationship. It's on the shelf right behind me somewhere here. But South Africa and Israel as allies, of course, during the apartheid era of South Africa. Now South Africa has been leading the way in criticizing and trying to brand as genocide what's going on.
Yeah, I think of all the countries to bring a suit, South Africa was probably the most appropriate.
Yeah.
Based on its history. Well, we want you to promote your books and your website, because your website is just loaded with resources and links and other videos where people can find, because we've just touched on a little bit of all of the things that you've discussed and gone into. So,
well, what I'd urge people to do is, you know, you can go to the website or just type in Hickson Lobby and videos. And not just mine, but I've spoken a couple of times at the annual Israel Lobby Conference. So the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs and IRMIP, the Israel Middle East Policy Think Tank in Washington, promoted this conference that I spoke at a couple of times. You know, they had Roger Waters last year. Some great Israeli journalists have spoken there. You can get access to other videos. I mentioned the Electronic Intifada. I mentioned Mondo Weiss. There's plenty out there for people. There's a lot of great books. Some of them are behind me on my shelf here to read on. It's not from a lack of information. The knowledge is out there. It's just putting it into effect to make fundamental change is the sort of final step that that needs to be taken. And maybe we're heading that way again. I wish I knew also where we were going, but you know, on September 10th, 2001, you thought the world was one place, and the next day it was very much another place. And so that can happen in history. And my antenna tell me we're heading for big changes one way or another, not just on this issue, but American politics is sliding toward an abyss and is highly dysfunctional. You know, something's got to give in some of these directions. And history does often have a way of pulling a lot of things together. And, you know, when one big thing changes, other big things change. So we'll have to see if we live long enough what goes on here.
I'd really like you to expand on that before we go.
Well, I can do it, you know, as a historian. So history doesn't repeat itself. That's a cliche, but certain things play out in a similar fashion. So, you know, I'm not utterly want to dismiss the concept. But if you look at U.S. history in the 1850s, and obviously, although apparently Nikki Haley didn't learn this, you had slavery and obviously an overriding issue that made politics dysfunctional. But we have very similarly dysfunctional politics today. In other words, our political system is not working. We can barely fund the government. And, you know, the contentiousness is reminiscent of the antebellum period when they were bringing pistols into Congress and you didn't say things like my esteemed colleague from the great state of whatnot. You know, there's real contempt and a real inability to work together. So I view our political system as breaking down, and that has serious repercussions that'll create dramatic change. I may be wrong about this. It may, you know, restabilize, but I'm very concerned about what we're seeing. Don't predict the future, but I am deeply concerned, and I think we are. Maybe abyss is too strong, but I think there are grave political problems, and they're linked with these international issues. And I think we're going to see something dramatic that changes things, you know, as we've seen in the past, whether it's 9/11 or the Great Depression or World War II, World War I, you know, history delivers these massive events that change everything. And I just sense we're heading towards something.
There's a lot of discussion in the media, especially in the independent media, that Biden's unwavering support of Israel is undermining his reelection.
I think it is hurting him. There's no question that it's not just the relatively small number of people who go out to rallies and chant genocide Joe, but there are a lot of progressive people who, I'm not going to vote for him, which is very hard for me because I certainly think Trump is a dangerous man and a real problem. I just can't vote for somebody who's funding and supporting mass slaughter. I just can't do it. I have the luxury, if you will, ironically, of living in Ohio, which Trump is going to carry, I think, no matter what. Mm-hmm. But so my vote doesn't matter in a sense. But I think it is going to hurt him. I think there are a lot of people like me. And I mean, it shows how powerful the lobby is, even though it is hurting him. They fear the effects of going against Israel in the law. Even, you know, it's just a ceasefire, for God's sake. It's not making any real sacrifices to Palestinians or, God knows, creating a state. You asked if there's anything else I'd mention. About the only thing I can think of is I refer to the mythical peace process. There's never been a genuine peace process that Israel has pursued. It's never... If Israel had wanted there to be a Palestinian state and a peace agreement to create one, there would have been one by now. And now there's no room for a Palestinian state, because if your listeners aren't aware, what's happened is by putting off a peace agreement simultaneously, now more than 700,000 settlers, quote unquote settlers, have poured into illegally occupation of Palestinian territory. It's all about an illegal occupation. So Israel is legal. Israel was established by the UN. Whatever you think about it, Israel is a legitimate state in the eyes of the international community because the UN created it. What is not legitimate has been this occupation of Palestinian territory. It's totally unlawful. It's repressive and unjust. And it's precluded a peace agreement. So Israel's never, you know, and these Democrats and some Republicans say, well, we need to get the war stopped and have a two-state solution. The argument for a two-state solution is just a non-starter any longer. It was possible in the 1970s. It's no longer possible. Too much of Palestine is occupied by the Jewish illegal wildcat settlements to the tune of over 700,000 people. What you could have in Israel, people say, well, people who don't know anything about it say, well, they've been killing each other for centuries. It'll never stop. There's nothing we can do about it. I argue somewhat glibly, we can end this whole thing tomorrow. All you have to do is have free and unfettered democratic elections, and you could have a legitimate state. Call it Israel-Palestine, or, you know, maybe call it Israel with areas that are called Palestine, something. I really genuinely believe that most people would be way more concerned about getting jobs and earning money for their families and living a decent life and having nice things than they would be about killing each other. In other words, I think Israeli Jews and Palestinians could coexist. You know, nobody thought it would change in South Africa. Nobody thought it was possible there. Look how the Balkans was ripped apart. So these things can change, people can change, and I really believe the one-state solution, creating a genuine democracy, would bring peace to the region and have all sorts of positive spinning out effects all over the world and in the United States. But getting there has been the hard thing.
Do you find some hope or encouragement from the generational divide and how young people seem
I do. I do. My sister keeps telling me I'm too pessimistic and that these millennials are going to change the world. I hope she's right. We'll have to see. But yeah, I think so. I mean, they don't, they're tired, I think, of a lot of these old world issues, and they're probably not real pleased about the world we're leaving to them for good reason. And that's another thing, climate change, that makes me think we're in for big changes and revolutionary events. But yeah, I hope so. I hope the millennials, or whatever we're calling this next generation now, will do things differently. Absolutely. There's some hope there. Yeah. We have to have some hope, right?
We got to have some hope. And your website is walterhickson.com.
Yeah.
And that's WALTERHIXSON.
Yeah. SON. Some people forget the S from time to time. Yep. HIXSON. Yep.
SON.com, loaded with books,
Yeah, I think
videos,
the one
discussions.
I want to push is Architects of Repression. It was written for, not for a academic audience alone. The Israel's Armor book is more academic. Architects of Repression makes all the points I want to make, and I think a readable way. Thank you all for giving
really
me all this
great
time to talk about that. I think I've mentioned about everything I know. And again, there are so many good sources out there. Don't hesitate, you listeners, to go out and inform yourselves further in some of the sources that I mentioned. I certainly don't know everything about it. I have some expertise on the lobby, but a lot of people have more expertise on Gaza, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Finkelstein's work on Gaza is astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Jewish American who was just appalled by what was being done in the name of his religion. His parents were Holocaust survivors, and he's appalled at how the Holocaust has been manipulated to support these repressive policies. So there's just a ton of good stuff out there. And inform yourself and lobby for the right thing to do, which is just to, not slaughter people and to let them live in peace, for God's sake.
All right. Excellent. Now, we always end with a song. Is there a song you could recommend that we play to end the show with that kind of relates to what we've been talking about?
Well, if they won't think I'm too dangerous and radical, I'd recommend Imagine by John Lennon.
We will play Imagine by John Lennon. And we appreciate so much you taking the time and coming on and talking to us. Hopefully we can get on your calendar sometime in the future and maybe follow up with what you talked about and see what history has done to us in the meantime.
Well, that'd be great. And, you all don't have to do what you do either. And so you deserve a lot of credit for having the energy and taking the time and making the effort. And, I think it's really important for grassroots groups like you and veterans groups, people who've sacrificed a lot for this country and not always been rewarded or treated properly for it. So I think it's great work that you guys do as well.
I'd like to throw in before the end, a nod to Jewish Voice for Peace.
Yeah, I should have mentioned
so
that.
I'm proud of what they have done and what they're doing.
A great organization. Absolutely. JVP is terrific. Thank you for bringing that up. I neglected to mention them. Thank
we'll
you very
you.
Much.
We'll
I'll send
you
on my website, and I sure appreciate the opportunity, and best wishes to you guys.
Take care. All right.
So long.
Peace. So now, let's imagine.
Say